Okay, for the record, it's November 29th, 2023, 9 o'clock a.m. I'm Phil Albrecht, hearing examiner for Kitsap County. We are on day two of the Silverview Apartments SEPA and conditional use permit appeals. File numbers 2300913, 23-02979. We were still in the appellant's presentation. Ms. Clungeon had presented her direct testimony on Mr. Matthew, and we're now in the cross-examination phase. Before we jump into that, was there anything else we needed to address before we get on board here today? No, it looks like we're ready to go. So, Ms. Clenchin, is your witness present today? See, I think Ms. Walston's bringing him in.
Should be coming over here. There we go.
Okay.
Connecting now.
And actually, one thing I just kind of thought of this morning, something to think about and maybe address at the end of the hearing before we get to Mr. Matthew's testimony is I know this hearing has a lot of diagrams and people scribbling things on them. I think as Mr. Bricklin pointed out, it's a little difficult if you're just reading a transcript to figure out what's going on. I thought maybe what might kind of solve that for appeal purposes would be admission of the Zoom video as an exhibit, so that people writing there, if this, God forbid, this goes to judicial appeal, people can reference, minutes in the videotape to back up that, they were scribbling in the northwest corner or whatever, that kind of thing. I mean, like I said, that's something to think about, and just remind me at the end of the hearing if you'd like to just admit the video as an exhibit there. I think that might facilitate a appellate review, or obviously on appeal you could just stipulate that's an exhibit as well, but it's just something to consider to make this hearing a little easier as well. So anyway, let's get to Mr. Matthew. I'll put you under oath again just to be safe. Let's start off right. Do you swear affirm tell the truth, nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
Morning.
Morning. Okay.
And Mr. Albrecht, Dave Bricklin here. On that point, about, I think one of my witnesses last night sent me, somehow had taken a screenshot of one of those scribbling things. So I'm not familiar with this technology to know how to do that. But apparently, there's a method to do that, and somebody who's knowledgeable, maybe when we could pause when people scribble, or at least important scribbles, and
Oh, I see. Oh, to
take a
take a
screenshot.
screenshot?
I don't know. Just
Yeah,
throwing that out.
that's a good idea. Miss Walston, is that something you're able to do screenshots?
Yeah, I can. I would
Okay.
say when you do want something, make sure to specify, if we could get a screenshot of this for the record.
Okay.
And then that way I'll know for sure and make sure I'm capturing exactly what's on the screen, that kind of thing. And actually I've got, yeah, so just make sure that you're are clear about what you want captured and we'll do it.
Yeah, that's a great idea. Okay, all right.
Sorry
Yeah,
to
so
make
yeah, if
more
somebody
work for
wants a
you.
screenshot, just say so and we'll get that done. Thanks, Mr. Bricklin. All right, Mr. Matthew, I guess now is who wanted to go first, Mr. Lin or Mr. Gekas?
I'm ready to if Mr.
Okay.
would.
Yeah, I mean, I'm used to the usually the government attorney wants to go last to try to maintain, be as I guess as neutral as possible while maintaining the staff's recommendation. And I mean, I don't know, Mr. Gekas, if that's kind of like the way you like to do it, but
Oh, no, if Mr. Lin goes first, that works great.
yeah, okay, that's what I thought.
All right.
Okay, all right, Mr.
Thank
Lin,
you.
go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Matthew.
Good morning.
I understand from your testimony yesterday that one of your concerns is preserving the current distribution of water around in and around the site. Is that an accurate characterization?
I would call it protecting the patterns, the hydrologic patterns that currently exist under existing conditions.
Okay, maintaining what's there now in terms of patterns.
Yes.
Okay, and you also expressed a concern about water quality, correct?
Yes.
Okay. I gather from your testimony that you're familiar with the State Department of Ecology's stormwater manual,
Yes.
adopted on a statewide basis.
Yes, I am.
And that fair to say that that stands as a state standard on protection of water quality? It's one of them.
It is one of them, yeah.
And you're required that, or aware that the applicant here will be required to obtain an NPDES permit from the Department of Ecology.
I would assume that, yes. But
okay, and you're also familiar with Kitsap County's version of the stormwater manual that would have had to have been approved by the Department of Ecology?
Yes, I'm familiar with it.
Okay, and it's the standard for the design of stormwater systems in the county?
Yes.
And the county has approved to date the conceptual plans and will have to approve ultimately the final stormwater plans for the site, correct?
Yeah. Yes, I believe that's true. Yep.
And that's not something you do, is it? You're not a professional engineer. You do not design, nor are you able to design stormwater systems to meet county requirements. Is that correct?
No, you are correct. I'm not an engineer, but I've been in this business long enough to understand some of the ins and outs and nuances of what stormwater engineers do and how they design and what works and what doesn't.
Okay. And I understand that. I wasn't trying to belittle your accomplishments, your qualifications. I just wanted to make clear that if you submitted a plan to Kitsap County, they couldn't accept it.
That is correct.
Okay.
I'm a registered geologist, hydrogeologist, not a licensed engineer.
Yep. Right. Okay. And you mentioned a model that had been done by the applicant's engineers with respect to the water entering onto the site. Is that correct?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay. So a model has been done, and you're aware of that. You just don't think there's enough data that's part of that?
What I would say about that model is that model is basically designed and geared towards dealing with the stormwater runoff that's going to occur after the site is developed with, say, 2/3 to 3/4 of impervious surfaces. And it's a model that is actually quite reasonable for managing that stormwater runoff and designing a system that can actually physically shunt that water to different locations. What that model does not do, it does not recognize the natural system that currently exists there and the water that moves from the site into the downgradient neighborhood to the south and southwest, and how the impacts of the development will affect that neighborhood. The model completely dismisses that and ignores that.
Well, it's not the particular model, it's the stormwater manual, isn't it, that focuses on stormwater and not subsurface movement of groundwater.
Say that again. I'm not sure exactly what you're getting at.
It's the storm manual that focuses on stormwater, correct? Not subsurface water, as you just described.
The stormwater manual, the Kitsap County stormwater drainage manual, drainage design manual, actually says there has to be an examination of existing patterns and an effort to maintain those. And I'm saying that that stormwater model that was developed does not address that policy or that mandate.
Does the manual set forth any methodology for determining subsurface flows?
Does the manual do that?
Yes.
I'm not exactly clear what the manual says about the type of techniques and field techniques that are used to do that.
Okay, the manual is some 1,200 or 1,400 pages long. You're not aware of anything in that tells a designer how to model the subsurface or how to investigate the subsurface flows?
There is some references to techniques, but the specifics of those I cannot cite right now.
Okay. So the groundwater flows, we spent a lot of time talking about the 5-acre site. There's a lot more to the groundwater system than just this 5-acre site, isn't there? Isn't there a much larger groundwater basin that flows into the same sites that you mentioned yesterday, the estuary and so forth?
Are you talking about the groundwater basin that contributes flow into the 5-acre site? Is that what you're asking me? Or are you asking about where, what the entire system looks like, both the inflows to the site and the outflows to the site? What are you asking?
Let's take them both. I was talking about the entire basin, but there are flows into the sites from properties to the west and north, correct?
No, there are flows into the site from the east side of the property.
I'm sorry, I got my directions mixed up. You're correct. East and north?
A small amount from the north, but there is a significant amount of groundwater inflow to the site, the 5.3 acre site, from the east.
And then there are additional groundwater sources below the site, that is on the water side of the site, in that residential area that you described.
There is groundwater that discharges from the site along the entire south boundary of the proposed development into the neighborhood to the south and southwest.
At which time it collects together with additional water that then gathers and flows towards the Dyes Inlet area.
It gathers with additional water that falls as rainfall on that south neighborhood, yes.
Okay, so in essence, the groundwater that ends up emerging from Dyes Inlet is not just from this site, but from properties to the east of it, to the north of it, and to the south and southwest of it. Isn't that correct?
Yes, now you're changing scales here. And so Dyes Inlet is a very large feature. So what you said is true, yes.
Okay, well, isn't it also true of the estuary? Aren't there flows that come from the properties to the north, east, and south of the site and flow to the estuary?
From the north, east, and southeast, and they do flow into the estuary, yes.
Okay, so I guess the point is that the groundwater system is more complicated than just this site, correct?
Yes.
And this site, do you know what percentage of the total basin this site represents?
No, and that is exactly what I've asked that your client should be doing. They should be revealing that to us. That is their burden.
And we'll get to the should part, because the should part really is up to the examiner. The point is that it's a more complicated, and when you talk about a radical change in the characteristics of the site, that does not necessarily mean that there's a radical or even meaningful change within the flows of the basin as a whole.
The basin as a whole, no. But again, you're upscaling the entire context, and I'm more focused on what's going on in the neighborhood to the directly to the south. That's a smaller scale than what you're talking about.
Exactly. My point exactly, that this has to be put in the context of what's going on overall within the groundwater system, not just focusing on one individual site.
I agree with you. It has to be put in the context of the overall system, but it has to be focused on where the impacts potentially would be.
Is it fair to say that any impervious surface added as part of a development changes the flow of surface water and its entry into the ground?
Yes.
Okay. So even if I put down a 2x2 foot paver, that is a change in the impervious surface.
Yes, sure.
And so all of the development that's occurred within the basin that's tributary to the estuary has had an impact on the groundwater, accurate? Maynard's Restaurant, for example, the houses to the east of the site, the houses south and southeast of the site, each one of those created impervious surface and changed the flow of water within the system, didn't it?
That is true.
Okay. And to the extent that this site reduces the level of impervious surface below the amount allowed, that's beneficial, isn't it, in the sense that it represents a more natural condition, it leaves some more additional area of the site intact and not altering the flow of groundwater?
To what degree are you reducing the amount of impervious surfaces?
Well, that's
that's a very vague statement, and I can't really answer that.
And I'm not supposed to testify, but I believe the difference is between 85% that's allowed and 67% that's proposed. So that twice as much open space as allowed. And the question is, isn't that reduction in impervious surface below what's allowed beneficial in terms of preserving the natural flows of water?
It is beneficial. However,
that's the end of the question. I just asked you whether it's beneficial.
It's beneficial. Yep.
Yeah, your attorney can follow up if they want to.
Okay.
So there have been some state efforts made to preserve the flows of groundwater in the storm drainage plan, have there not? Aren't there French drains, for example, along the north boundary of the property?
Yes, I have read something about that, but there's no quantification of it that actually is meaningful.
Well, isn't it a meaningful step to take the water that's flowing onto the site and direct it to the current place that it drains out in the southwest corner of the property? Doesn't that help achieve the purpose that you've identified of preserving the natural flows of water?
No, it does not.
Okay.
If you're taking water from one location and putting it into a completely different location, there's a potential impact in doing that.
Okay, but isn't that exactly what's required by the code to try to pass through water that currently enters into the site and return it to its natural point of departure?
Yes, but the concept is, if you recall yesterday, the characterization that I showed basically in those four sub-basins, each of those four sub-basins that I showed on that one exhibit, what is it, eight?
We recall it, I think, the four.
Anyway,
sub-basins.
There was four sub-basins there, and basically the proposed project is moving water around on that 5.3 acre property in a way that does not preserve the pattern of water that falls and moves through the soil and subsurface according to those basins that I characterized. It's actually moving water across the site. It's going to actually take water from one location and put it in a different location, thus having potential impacts on the groundwater flow system in the basin that it was taken from and put into. I don't agree with you that it's basically, I can't agree with you unless we're actually talking about, you know, where you're taking that water from and moving it to. But conceptually, it may not be mimicking the existing hydrologic patterns.
Okay. So is it your contention is here there are four basins, and that's just based, I think, on LIDAR evidence? Is that where you derive those four basins?
The foundational data set that was used to do that is the county's LIDAR data, yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's a yes or no question. Yes, it was based on LIDAR, correct?
It was, yes.
Okay.
Well, more specifically, I could say it's a digital elevation model. That's actually more meaningful to most people.
Well, it's not to me. I do know what LIDAR is. I'm not sure I know what the other is. But
LIDAR is a technique. The digital elevation model is what's developed for people to use want to do analysis.
All right. So with respect to these four basins, is it your contention that in order to fully replicate what's out there, we'd have to have a separate system, a separate study for each basin, and then a separate study or a separate design for each basin so that each one of those four components replicates what was there before?
To a certain degree, yes. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. And if there were 80 basins, we'd also have to have 80 systems and 80 studies?
No. What I'm asking you to do is basically characterize the site in a way that actually protects and preserves the hydrologic patterns down gradient from the site. In other words, you have to identify what hydrologic features exist in that neighborhood to the south, the downgradient neighborhood to the south. From that point, going back up into the site, then you can characterize the number of basins you need to basically examine so that you can then preserve what is going on downgradient or downstream or downhill, whatever word you want to take. That's what I'm saying. I'm not saying you need to have 80 basins. That's ridiculous. But
well,
maybe you ought to have four, maybe you ought to have three, but the characterization has to look at the downstream or downgraded impacts that you're having. Furthermore, a sub-basin around that wetland needs to be defined too. And you got to understand the hydrology of that.
Another topic we'll get.
Okay. There. All right.
Well, Ms. Clungeon's about to object to my interruption, but the witness is answering questions that haven't been answered, and we're trying to move along here. We got through 1.5 witnesses yesterday.
So. Okay, Ms. Clungeon.
Oh, I was just going to ask him to let him finish. His testimony was related to the question that Mr. Lin asked. So.
Okay. Mr. Matthew, did you get your whole response in there?
Yeah, the last thing I was going to say was that there has to be an appropriate sub-basin that's defined around that wetland. And there has to be an understanding of the hydrology within that sub-basin that feeds the wetland. Otherwise, that wetland will be completely destroyed, you know, under the post-development conditions.
Okay, thanks. All right.
So I'm objecting to the exaggeration that there needs to be 80 basins, or there has to be something, you know, extravagant like that. There's an appropriate number of basins.
Okay. So are you familiar with the conditions of approval? And are you aware that there is a condition that requires that hydrology be maintained for the wetland in accordance with the stormwater manual? Condition 19.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So with respect to the four basins and the need to understand precisely what happens, do you work on development projects as the proponent of a development, of a specific development? Is that something that you do regularly?
It's not something I do regularly. I have done it.
Okay. How recently?
Probably about 15 years ago, I worked on a small development.
Okay, so can you? So we talked about the French drains, which you do not think sufficiently or at all help mimic the pre-existing conditions. What about the footing drains around the buildings? Are you familiar that those are proposed to pick up additional water and return it to the ground?
I'm not exactly clear exact where that water would be shunted to, where it would be conveyed to in the footing drains. Okay. But I am aware that there are footing drains.
Okay. Which so that is not a detail you've taken into account.
I don't know exactly where the water that is picked up by the footing drains actually gets routed to. So I'm just being honest here, Mr. Lin, that I don't know that.
Okay, I that's fine.
Yeah.
And to the extent that water falls on areas of the site that are currently undeveloped and remain undeveloped, those I assume fall into the ground and follow the paths that they would have prior to development?
Hypothetically, yes. But let me just say this. Whenever you develop a site and you have heavy equipment moving around on a site, it actually changes the hydraulic, it can change the hydraulic properties of the soil. It can make them less permeable, which means there can be less recharge during a rainfall event. Okay. It can compact the soil and change the hydraulic properties. So even though you're leaving, you said what, 33%? Would be impervious, is that right?
I think that's correct, yes.
unless your construction practices in the in that 33% allow for maintaining the soil hydraulic properties, i.e. not running over them with, you know, huge backhoes and heavy equipment, you are going to change the hydraulic characteristics of that soil and potentially reducing its infiltration capacity.
Okay. And is that something we should study as well?
You don't have to study it. There's actually, there's construction practices that allow you to manage that in a much better way than just, you know, not looking at, not examining it.
So in terms of quality, the water that's picked up by the footing drains, the water that's picked up by the foundation drains, and the water that falls on open space area does not require treatment, does it? That's, it doesn't present a quality problem.
As long as that is coming off of surfaces that are not dissolving, you know, contaminants in them, yes.
Well, it would, if there is a water quality issue, it wouldn't be the applicants, because this is water that's just coming onto the site from some other source, correct?
You mean coming on the, like rainfall, hitting a roof, and then going through a downspout?
Rainfall or groundwater from adjoining properties to the north and east?
That would be water that would not not need to be treated if it's coming, if it's lateral flow of groundwater from offsite to onsite.
And while we're on the subject of quality, the project proposes sanitary sewers. I would assume that the septic systems around the property pose a water quality issue that's not presented by the subject property because of that?
That depends on how well those septic systems are maintained and what technology is being used to process that sanitary water from those individual homes.
Okay. Wouldn't you expect that houses of the vintage that we see in that neighborhood would not have state-of-the-art septic systems?
Well, there's some new homes there in that neighborhood too.
All right.
So you know, that's speculation. I can't speculate on that.
Okay. Can't say.
I operate a septic system at a cabin, and it's state of the art. And you know, the cabin is over 100 years old.
Okay, and you can't say that that's not preferable, or that septic or the sanitary sewer is not preferable to that.
Sanitary sewer would be preferable in most cases, I would say. Yeah. But, I'm not going to speculate how people maintain their septic systems.
Okay. So we've talked about the systems that kind of carry water through the site. You understand that some portion of the stormwater, in fact, the part that falls on impervious surfaces, is collected, treated, and then taken to an existing storm line in Buckland Hill Road.
I do understand that.
Okay. And the manual calls out the methods for water quality treatment, does it not?
Yes.
Okay.
But Mr. Lynn, there's also a line going from the southwest corner of the proposed development southward along Mickleberry Road in part, and then discharging into the estuary, the neighborhood estuary there.
And do you understand that the purpose of that is to help bring the level of water within that system to the point it was in the pre-developed condition? Wasn't that water to make up additional flows to ensure that the pre-development conditions were mimicked according to the manual?
Yes, I do understand that. However, I've reviewed that civil report, and I do have some problems with the pre-existing conditions that they have modeled there. And I'm not convinced that they've actually matched or reduced the proposed flow in that conveyance line to match what is currently going in that conveyance line.
Is that something that a professional engineer would have to do in order to satisfy county requirements?
You mean to match the flows? Yes. Pre-existing and app?
Yeah. Isn't that part of the function of the civil engineer under review by the county, and in this case, a third party reviewer?
Yes, that is the function of the civil engineer to do that.
Okay. Is it fair to say that all of the development in this groundwater system that feeds the estuary, the development to the north, the development to the east, the homes to the south, all of those would have affected the rate, location, and timing of the groundwater flow?
To a certain degree, that is true, yes.
Okay.
But again, we're talking scale here.
Well, and 5 acres relative to a basin of considerably larger size, right?
5 acres is substantial in terms of the impact it will have on that downgradient neighborhood and in the estuary at those outfalls, at the point of where the, you know, you're discharging water.
But if the if you describe the current down gradient system as being of good quality with good habitat, correct?
It is a system that has I cannot say what the quality of the habitat is currently, but I do know there is restoration work ongoing, and so the concern would be how does this project impact that ongoing restoration?
Okay, but it isn't it fair to say that whatever's happened to date, all the development that's occurred within this, all the foundations that have been dug, all the septic systems that have been built, all the rerouting of footing drains and foundation drains, the streets, driveways, parking areas, and all that, none of that isn't it true that all of that has had an effect to date, that what we see out there today is by no means the natural condition of this area?
That is true. Yes.
Okay. Now I want to talk about just a couple more topics here. You talked about critical areas yesterday, and you pointed to the purpose section of the critical areas ordinance. Doesn't that section specifically say it? The critical areas provisions do not apply to development that does not exceed the thresholds set forth in water quality standards. I mean, isn't it as a in total aimed at uses like gas stations and feedlots and uses that are expected to have a water quality impact? Ruben, I don't know if you can pull that up or not, but I'm looking at section. So this is the critical aquifer recharge area, section 19600 under the Kitsap County Code. You read or were asked questions about the purpose section, but if you look at the last sentence of that purpose section, it says, in addition, these requirements do not apply to those activities that have potential contaminant sources below threshold amounts as set forth in applicable standards, statutes of the Revised Code of Washington or local regulations. Doesn't that sentence encompass residential development? Isn't residential development expected to have contaminant sources below state levels?
Residential development, yeah, is typically expected to have that, although this code, I believe, I think there's also some clause in here about the county having some discretion too over what they consider. Down. Is that true or not?
Yeah, we're going to scroll down to that. Okay. So section, if you could go back up a little bit, the next section, 615, describes the two categories of critical aquifer protection areas. This one, category one or category two, being the less restricted. Is that your testimony yesterday? It's category two, critical area, aquifer recharge area.
It is a category two.
Okay. That's so correct. Category one is more restricted. And in the case of category one, it prohibits certain uses unless you get a waiver. And unless you, if you want to get a waiver under subsection A2, you have to have a hydrological report. Is that how you read that, paragraphs A1 and 2 under 615?
Could you guys enlarge it a little bit? It's really not legible, I think, to me. I don't know about everybody else. How about a little more? Okay, so you're looking at category 2B, part B, yes. Category 2?
Right.
And you're saying, you're asking, what is the question again?
Sorry. Let's go back. First of all, in B2, there's a list of land uses in 620. And Ruben, maybe you could scroll to that. That's a list of uses that are either prohibited or restricted. We're not proposing any of those things, are we? Not a laundromat or a junk and salvage yard or airport maintenance or food processing or anything like that. We're not on the list of prohibited or limited uses, are we?
Let's see. I saw a golf course in there. What about, was there any sort of park, or was there any parks in here? You guys are okay. Yeah. Yeah, I don't believe you're proposing any of these items here.
Okay. So let's go back up to the category 2 discussion. Doesn't that category 2, and this is the substantive standard in this whole critical areas code, it just says land uses identified in this category 2 aquifer recharge area, they're not prohibited. It's just that they may be required to submit a hydrological report.
Yes, and the scope of the report shall be based on site-specific conditions.
But the point is, we're not proposing a land use that falls within the category. Isn't that correct?
You're not proposing any land uses from that list. But let's not forget that, you know, you're bringing in a high density of cars and parking lots that will have runoff, and that runoff will have stormwater contaminants in it that could potentially impact the estuary.
Okay.
And Clear Creek, where the water's going down Buckland Hill Road to discharge there. Clear Creek being a coho spawning salmon run. So,
wait, go ahead.
Anyway.
So you're saying the hearing examiner should rewrite this and add some other uses to the list because they have parking lots? I mean, wouldn't that pretty much include any land use in Kitsap County?
I'm saying with the density of people and their vehicles and the parking lots that you have at this site, I would use some discretion here and examine that very carefully. Okay, and Mr. Lin, let me just say something.
Yeah,
you know, I would like to just say something a little divergent here, and I hope you'll just humor me a little bit and bear with me for a minute. And I know you're kind of hard pressed to get through this testimony, but we do have what I call a legacy contaminant that has been identified, and the science is good. It's hard. It's shown that runoff from hard surfaces that vehicles drive over generate this contaminant called 6 PPD, and it transforms into a quinone, and that is highly toxic to coho salmon. So the thing about legacy chemicals is there's usually decades before they're actually identified as a problem, where there's a lot of research and trying to figure out what is killing a certain animal. Then there's typically another several decades or two decades before that actually is regulated out of the system. We're kind of right in the middle of that right now in Puget Sound. We have a lot of people, a lot of energy, and a lot of money who are really concerned about the Puget Sound ecosystem. And this chemical is deadly to coho salmon. That is a fact. Furthermore, the Washington Stormwater Center has developed some really good mitigation techniques for dealing with this chemical. To not adopt some of those, I think, is irresponsible. So this is where I'm actually asking you guys to take a look at this and examine it as part of your design plan, stormwater design plan. Okay. I'm off my soapbox.
I was actually going to get to 6 PPD in a minute because that was another of your recommendations. But you mentioned concerns for the creek and the estuary and the need to clean up the water. The fact is that the county has an adopted standard for methodologies to address water quality, correct?
Yes.
And the applicant's going to be required to meet those, correct?
Yes.
And so far, the county and the third-party reviewer have found that they do meet that test.
I believe so.
And you're suggesting that the examiner add to the list, and I can't quite tell what the parameters are, but you would add to the list of uses prohibited in that chart in paragraph 620, other dense developments with lots of people and lots of parking. Is that the standard you're asking the examiner to create here?
I'm asking for some discretion on the examiner's part to recognize where we are in the history of this legacy contaminant and doing something that is very obviously, in my mind, a fairly simple step, and that is to track what's going on at the Washington Stormwater Center and adopt some of the treatment technologies that they are finding are working.
Okay, so sticking with 6 PPD, which you've raised, isn't that a subject that's being considered as the topic for regulations on a statewide and even national level?
Yeah, the EPA is working on it, and so is the state, and it's moving forward. But you know, I've had friends that have worked at EPA for the last 30 years, and it's usually a decade or two decade process to get regulation coming down from EPA that the state will adopt. So there's an opportunity to do the right thing here. And even before the regulation has been adopted federally or by the state.
It's not even proposed. Is there a specific standard even proposed on the table up for discussion?
There's not a standard. There's not a contaminant standard concentration yet. No.
Okay. So the examiner should bypass that regulatory process that takes into account views of lots of people and lots of other considerations and just ad hoc adopt a standard here that he's going to hold these applicants to unique among Kitsap County properties?
I wouldn't call it ad hoc, and I wouldn't say that. I mean, that's a little hyperbolic to say that there's a lot of things that, personal things that people are asking for. This is one very specific contaminant, one issue that has been plaguing Puget Sound for the last 25 years and creeks that flow into Puget Sound. And I'm saying that there are some mitigation alternatives here in terms of treatment that would be important to adopt. That's what I'm saying.
Okay. And you're asking the examiner to do that.
Yeah. And let me just say this, Mr. Lynn. It's also a recognition of something that is culturally important to our tribal neighbors. So this is a way of seeing their cultural history too, and actually adopting something that, again, is going to help Puget Sound and the ecosystem in Puget Sound.
Okay, great. Thank you for your opinions.
Yep.
Is that it?
No further. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay, Mr. Getches.
Thank you. I had a rebuttal exhibit I wanted to pull up, but I just emailed it this morning. I just received it this morning. Wondering if maybe I can find out if that's okay to use. We could be able to call it C3.
the other parties have any objection to entry of the rebuttal document?
I have not seen it.
Did you get?
We need an opportunity for our expert to review it as well.
Do you have it though?
Yeah, it was email. I mean, you're on the email list, Ms. Clungeon. I'm not sure.
What size was the attachment?
It's not even an attachment. It's just a map from Parcel Search showing which parcels abutting Mickleberry are served by the Silverdale Water District.
It was transmitted after the start of this morning's hearing. So if Ms. Clungeon was paying attention to the testimony and not reading emails, she wouldn't have seen it yet.
Okay, I'm looking at it now. I have no objection to that exhibit. That's fine.
Okay, Mr. Lynn, I take it you're okay with that. So yes, no, we'll admit that as I think is it C3, I believe? That's the numbering. Yeah, so it'll be admitted as C3.
See if I can pull it up.
So is it the email that will be exhibit or just the map? Yeah,
just the map. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you for that clarification.
Well, there is an email. I was thinking the email would be admitted that includes the map in it, because otherwise we're not going to know what the map is for. There's just a couple sentences in the email.
Okay. Mr. Clungeon, any problem with that? I'm trying to pull it up here again.
And there is part of the email above the map that says attorney-client privilege. That's not correct. That's an old heading from another email that I deleted out anything that was privileged. So there's nothing in here that's attorney-client privileged.
Okay. Ms. Clungeon, any problem with the whole email going in?
Only that it makes statements about where certain parcels get their water from. And I don't know that our expert has had the opportunity to review that or verify that information. So I don't know if that's correct, but apart from that caveat, no objection.
Okay, I'll allow it. Yeah, C3.
Try to pull it up.
So I could, just for terminology, this is being offered not for rebuttal, but for cross-examination.
Okay.
Yeah, just give you a chance to look at this. Let me see if I can make it bigger. And you'll see this looks like four parcels, but these two parcels are the same parcel, you can tell by this number. So it's really three parcels. You can see the subject property here, Mickleberry Road, Buckland Hill Road, Tracy Tim Boulevard over here, to kind of get an idea of what we're looking at. And then you can see my question here that I'm asking Mr. Beam is Assistant General Manager at the Silverdale Water District, saying, Mr. Getchess, I verify that the only parcels on the map below that are on Mickleberry Road not being served by Silverdale Water District are the three highlighted ones. Do you want more of a chance to look at this, Mr. Matthew, or?
No, I understand what you're saying. So you're, okay, well, let me reiterate what I think you just said. The parcels in green are served by municipal water, is that right? It's piped in?
It's the other way.
Oh, right. The other way. Okay.
Yeah.
Only those. Okay. So those three parcels, and I see where 1-077 is actually sort of looks like it's in two parts, but it's actually one parcel.
Yep.
Those three parcels have their own water supply.
Yeah, those ones are not served by Silverdale Water.
Not served by Silverdale. Okay. So what's the question or the rebuttal question, or not rebuttal, but
what cross-examination
question here?
If you recall your testimony yesterday, towards the end of your testimony, I wrote down that you had said, and correct me if I got this wrong, but that you had said the shallow aquifer is the source of water in that down gradient neighborhood. And I thought this was relevant to that. Do you recall making that statement?
Yes. And I stand by that statement.
Okay.
But let me clarify, because I think there's some confusion here. The shallow aquifer is the source, the shallow aquifer and water beneath the proposed development site is a source of water to the downgrading neighborhood to the south. That is true. And what that water is doing is it's actually supplying water to features, landscape features, and like vegetation, wetlands, a pond, an open channel that flows from that pond, trees, and that's the part of the water supply to those features, those vegetation features, those hydrologic features. I did not say that that water, that shallow aquifer and its water is supplying potable drinking water.
Right. Okay? That's all I wanted to make, because I see how someone could hear that statement and think, if there's less groundwater, shallow aquifer groundwater coming off of the subject property, then these people won't have any water for drinking or bathing or any other purposes. And that's not correct, right?
What you just said is correct.
Yeah.
In other words, yeah, the shallow groundwater has no effect on the ability of those three parcels, 077, 118, 098, in terms of supplying their own potable water.
Well, and that's not because, so that's another issue that I thought is important to clarify, because it could be confusing. So even these that are not served by Silverdale Water District water, you're saying won't be affected. And I'm guessing that's because if they have wells, those wells are tapped into the artesian aquifer, not the shallow aquifer, right?
Correct. That's my understanding. I haven't visited each one of the wells at each of those sites, and I don't know, I don't have the well logs in front of me, but I imagine that they are tapped into the deeper artesian aquifer.
And you even mentioned an artesian flowing well yesterday, right? And so that's one example that, you know, there's at least one example of a well down there that is tapped into the artesian aquifer, right?
Yes, I do know that.
And so, before we leave the topic of the artesian aquifer, just because it can be confusing when you've got multiple aquifers, the artesian aquifer is not recharged by the shallow aquifer because of the thick confining till layer that's impermeable, right?
In this vicinity, and when I say vicinity, I mean in the proposed development area and in the neighborhood to the south, that shallow aquifer is not recharging the artesian aquifer.
And
that is true.
And let me ask if this is correct. Is the reason why it's an artesian aquifer and why there's so much pressure pushing up because the recharge area is on a hill somewhere?
The recharge area is further away from this vicinity, as you just said, and it is up gradient or uphill.
Okay.
So that's how I would characterize it.
Okay.
Just a little nuanced difference than what you said.
All right. Let me think here. Now I want to talk about, I may have to pull up another exhibit, but do you remember when you were looking at, it was exhibit 17, it was the photo, the aerial view, and you were drawing in blue ink, and you sort of drew a line from the corner of this property to the estuary, to right here where they wanted to put some oysters. Is that about the area where you were pointing that the?
Yes, approximately.
That script that was showing between lots 20022 and lot 118 and the estuary.
That is approximately the area where the outfall runs from the southwest corner of the proposed development into the estuary. And it's also pretty much in this proposed oyster, Olympia oyster restoration habitat area.
Right. And well, the first thing that I, when you just draw a line, that makes it seem like there's a pipe there, but won't there be a riprap pad up here and then go into an unlined ditch and then go into a culvert under the road and then maybe into a pipe?
I don't have that design that the applicant has. I don't have that in my mind exactly what the design looks like. And that might be a better question for the stormwater engineer expert.
Well, let's say hypothetically that it isn't an actual pipe, like an unperforated pipe, just taking it straight from here over to here, but there's actually a riprap pad and then an unlined ditch before you even get to Mickleberry Road. Wouldn't that give an opportunity for infiltration back into the shallow aquifer? At least some opportunity in that unlined ditch and riprap pad?
Yes, it would. And it actually would feed that potential wetland area that has not been evaluated appropriately by the applicant on the west end of that lot 1-063. So yes, you're right. It would allow some infiltration. It might even allow some overbanking of that during high flows that would then wet that area and recharge the shallow aquifer in that particular location right there. That's one location where there could be some recharge. Yes.
Also on the topic of recharge, because I thought you made a statement that might have been a little overbroad, where it was there's not going to be any more groundwater recharge in the shallow aquifer. And there will be some, right? Because let's say, for example, this border is landscaped. So if it's landscaped, and you mentioned, well, they might compact the soil, maybe the trees will have some, the roots will loosen it up. I don't know. But this won't be, since this is pervious, not impervious, there will be some recharge there in any other landscaped areas, right?
Mr. Getches, just, you know, for the transcript, when you're pointing at the screen, if you could kind of identify where you're pointing.
I was just moving the cursor along the southern border.
Okay.
The whole length of the southern border of the subject property.
Okay.
Yes, there could be some recharge in soil that is uncompacted and in an area where there's some vegetation. But let me also point out, yesterday I saw a drawing that I think was being shown to the appellant's architect expert, where there was a very high density cluster of trees proposed along that entire south boundary. And those trees will actually change the hydrologic water, you know, the water budget too for the site. They'll actually suck up water and transpire that water through their leaves. So that's also a change in the hydrologic system, which will affect the shallow groundwater, aquifer.
So they might suck up the water, but would it be offset a little bit by their providing shade, so it's not drying out and causing evaporation on the surface of the ground?
Yeah, and you could, I mean, you know, a hydrologist could figure this all out, this entire water budget.
Let me show you one other picture. I'll stop sharing this. And this is, to be honest, I was working on Teams after I was working on Zoom last night, and it's so much easier to share. You can have as many open as you want. Just click on any. With this, for it to work for me, I have to close everything else that's open and then only have one thing open in order to share it. It won't let me do it the other way. So let's go to that F1 exhibits. Open that. And go to Zoom. Go to share. Go to here. And now go to 3208. And this is Let's see, this is exhibit 51 and it's PDF page 3208 in the foundational exhibits. And this exhibit appears in various places in the foundational exhibits. And unfortunately, every place where it appears, it's not very readable. You can't read the words. And I'm not exactly sure why that is. But you can see, if you understand the system at all, it'll kind of explain how there's two different drainage systems in, and they're depicted in two different colors. You've got the one you were describing that takes water that touches impervious surfaces, surface water, and goes into catch basins. This is in green, and you can see the flow of the arrows and takes it over to Buckland Hill and then eventually over to the outfall, the Buckland Hill conveyance, Buckland Hill Road conveyance, west over to the outfall under the bridge where Clear Creek passes by into Dyes Inlet. So you've got that one and treats the water. So it should be clean before it goes over there because it's treated water. But then you've got the other system, which is in blue here, and that's not taking any water that's touched impermeable surfaces on the site. It's taking water that's coming from the ground under the groundwater from offsite underneath, and it's not even taking all of it. It's just, well, let me ask if you understand it this way. There's curtain drains, there's French drains along the footings of the apartment buildings to take some of that shallow groundwater away from the building, but not all of the water will go into those curtain drains. It's only the water that goes into those curtain drains and into this is perforated, but this isn't perforated. This high density polyethylene pipe here is not perforated, so it shouldn't take any of the water that's coming in to the landscaped area here. It should only take water from, and I kind of wish these blue lines went a little further, but as I understand it, the point I'm trying to get to is, wouldn't you agree that to the extent this is accurate, that the water that's going south is should both be clean? That's the first question. And the second question is, should not be all of the water that's underneath the concrete, it's just the water from the French drains that somehow makes it into those French drains, not the water below the French drains, not the water left or right of the French drains by too far, just the water that goes into the French drains, right?
So the question you're asking me is that, is the water that's conveyed via the blue line, is that clean water?
That's the first question, right?
First question. And if that is indeed groundwater and not water that is running off hard surfaces that have potential contaminants on it, then yes, that would be relatively clean water. Okay. The second question is, I think, about the water quantity in that blue line. Is that what you're saying or asking about?
Yes, because the second question had to do with there won't be any more, the statement where you had said there's not going to be any more groundwater recharge to the shallow aquifer. And as I understand it, it's not all of the shallow aquifer water that's going into those French drains. It's just whatever water does go into the French drains and whatever water goes into this perforated pipe, not water that goes under the pipe and doesn't make it into the pipe, or water that just passes on around and keeps going down, keeps flowing south.
Okay. So to answer that question about water quantity and exiting, at least exiting the southwest corner and going to the estuary in the neighborhood, first of all, I don't think I've ever seen anything that says how much water is currently flowing from the southwest corner under existing conditions. So for you to, or for the applicant to basically say, this is how much water we're going to push out the southwest corner, may not match what's currently going on at the southwest corner under existing conditions. Does that make sense?
It does. It does okay. make sense. But I was trying to address the broad statement that it won't be the shallow groundwater won't be recharged at all, and with the idea that this system won't capture. I mean, rainfall that goes on to this surface will now probably most of that rainfall will go into this system and be treated and go into Buckland Hill. So there's that loss of water that won't be going out this way.
Right.
Water that comes from off the site underneath, some of it will go into this, but not all of it, because this right here isn't perforated. It's just what's going into it from the, it's perforated where the French drains are, and it's perforated right here. And even where it's perforated, it won't capture it all, because some will go too far under, or if it's coming from here, you know, it might go and just never go into the French drain and just keep going on its normal way, right?
Oh, yeah. So if I said that there will not be no longer any groundwater, I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to. I don't believe I said there would never be any groundwater discharging.
No, groundwater recharge. I thought you said there won't be any more shallow aquifer recharge. There won't be any more shallow aquifer recharge, and there will be some more continued shallow aquifer recharge.
Well, yes, of course. In fact, you know, there. I definitely recognize that you're only putting impervious surfaces over anywhere from 67% to 73% is the number that I identified in one of the civil engineering drawings.
Well, and also,
so yeah, there's an additional percentage that's going to be open for recharge. So I can't believe that I made that statement yesterday that there will not be any recharge of the shallow aquifer on the site itself.
Okay.
I don't believe I said that.
All right.
But what I'm saying is there is going to be a change in the amount of groundwater recharge in the site, and the way that water is being routed. If you just look at the capture of that groundwater via the little stubs that are coming going north south off of this blue line on the south boundary, that water will no longer be flowing into the neighborhood to the south, and that's going to have an impact that has not been evaluated by the applicant.
Well, it'll change the flow. It'll come over here and then go into a riprap pad and then into an unlined ditch and then underneath Mickleberry Road, right?
Yes. Well, that's a change in the location of where that water is recharging, and that has not been evaluated by the applicant. Okay. And similarly, as I look and I see the small wetland that you guys have delineated in the middle, I don't see anything that suggests or talks about what the water requirements are for that wetland and how those water requirements are going to be met to maintain the integrity of that wetland in perpetuity.
Well, there was information about taking clean roof water and putting that in the wetland, right? And monitoring the amount.
You mean like watering it through a hose or something?
Above? No, it's like a downspout, as I understand it. See this green line right here?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's feeding the wetland a bit. But I don't want to talk too much about that if we've got experts that are going to testify about it. So it's not no water that's being sent to this wetland. There will be water sent to the wetland.
Okay. But do you know what the requirements of that wetland are to maintain its integrity? In other words, do you understand the seasonal changes in water levels that actually allow that wetland to thrive and then mimic that same pattern? I have not seen anything that shows that. And this is regardless of, you know, whether the wetland is as small as you have mapped it, or it's actually probably more accurately the size that Dr. Sarah Cook has mapped. And I actually was on site with Dr. Sarah Cook when she was delineating that wetland. So I've actually seen it.
if there's anything else. Okay, I don't have anything else. Any other questions for this
one? Okay. All right, Ms. Clenchin, back to you.
I know we're not quite at 90 minutes, but could I have just a couple of minutes to collect my notes?
Okay, well, I guess we can take our break now, then might as well. We'll come back then at 10:25.
Great, thank you.